listen to the best of the church's music for the Advent season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Advent season, LutheranPublicRadio.org. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's like a very slow motion sport watching the reporting around the U.S. Supreme Court. It's got tension because, of course, anytime you've got a case going to the Supreme Court, there's going to be one side and another side. There are going to be arguments on both sides. It's got the kind of tension that only comes from having to wait outside a courtroom, not allowed in to cover it, and to be able or directly with cameras and things like that, as we're used to today, waiting for someone to emerge and to tell you what happened, waiting for someone to emerge and hand you the written transcript, kind of old-fashioned reporting at that. And then, of course, there's the waiting for the decision. We're going to be talking about media coverage of Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission. Joining us to do so on this Thursday afternoon, Terry Mattingly, Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He is also founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Glad to be here.
I've been watching with some interest reporting on this story for, well, months, but now that the arguments have been made and have been heard, here's how I'm kind of reading the general reporting. Chances are the baker in this case is going to get some kind of a decision in his favor. And that really is just the story that Anthony Kennedy seems to side with the baker's arguments here. What do you think?
Well, you know, Kennedy has functioned as kind of our nation's monarch, our unelected monarch, for at least 20 years now. I mean, in the sense that almost every crucial case that goes to the court, he's the swing vote. And of course, to some degree, the election of Donald Trump merely put him right back in that swing vote position, because you had the death of a conservative champion, and he was replaced by someone who is viewed, at least at this point, as a young conservative champion in Gorsuch. So we're back to kind of having that classic what in the world do you do with Kennedy thing going on here. This is particularly fascinating because, A, Kennedy is rumored to be near retirement, to have been trying to make a decision about when to retire. And then if you needed more drama related to this one man, here is someone whose reputation at the Supreme Court and the view of, if you take a historical view of his tenure on the court, most people would agree that he's going to be famous for rulings on two subjects. One of them will be his opinions pioneering gay rights, even when he was writing in dissent, and then on into his swing vote decisions in favor of gay rights. But the other subject that he is best known for defending is freedom of expression and for basic First Amendment rights related to free speech. Has been strongly against the coercion of speech. And so thus we have a case which is exactly centering on both of those issues at the same time. And before the case, several people in Washington told me that the people defending the baker at Masterpiece Cake Shop were basically going to go in there and read Kennedy his own greatest hits on freedom of expression. And so it's no surprise at all that many of the stories centered on how Kennedy responded to the arguments of the different lawyers. By the way, Julia Dean of the Get Religion team has covered Supreme Court cases in person, something I've never done. You had kind of a genteel description of it. She described it as a nine-way knife fight between nine justices and two attorneys, with the justices constantly interrupting each other, constantly trying to kind of stick something in there as quick as possible to turn an argument in a different direction. So maybe it's a genteel, dignified knife fight.
Or as I said, maybe slow motion there. So let's just talk about the reporting so far here. There are different kinds of genres of reporting surrounding the Supreme Court. There's kind of the factual stuff. This is what they're going to hear. This is what they've allowed to go on their docket, what it may mean. Then there's the, here are the cases in particular that they want to hear, one side or the other, if it's good reporting. And then there's that ringside stuff that we get, which is waiting for someone to come out and talk on a microphone after they've either made their case. The only people you never hear from, of course, until the opinions are rendered, are the people whose decision matters the most. Talk about the different ways of covering this.
We don't get to have the equivalent of the football sideline interview, you know, with the coach walking off the field and someone runs up and sticks a mic in their face and says, "Justice Kennedy, halfway through this, you switch tactics and move from this to this. What are your plans for the decision?" I mean, you know, we don't have that sort of a thing. At the same time, I don't think I've ever learned a single important fact from a sideline interview in a major sports contest. So anyway, we're going to see stories here in the next couple of weeks. We could conceivably even get leaks from staff members. There's also a degree to which both sides like to spin the good and the bad. I noticed in this case, the left basically was saying, okay, that's it, no chance. Kennedy's clearly, you know, and then they quote the Kennedy remarks about tolerance and free speech, et cetera. And then the right, in this particular case, a lot of conservative analysts came out and said, here's five things that happened that we believe are bad. Here's five things that happened in this particular hearing that we thought were good. We tended, as always in the Donald Trump world, there are multiple conservative points of view. But on the subject of religious liberty and free speech, I think it's very important to try to look for the reactions of two different groups of people. Now, I mean, avoid reading stuff that's clearly written as a form of fundraising letter. In other words, like, this is horrible, please send in money to help us fight it. This was great, we had a great victory, please send in money for da-da-da-da-da. In this case, I would look, once again, at the kind of mainstream conservatism represented over the last year and a half, I think, represented best by several of the writers at National Review, primarily the person I've been stressing, someone I follow extremely closely, is the Harvard Law level analyst David French, who is a religious liberty specialist in many ways. You can read his commentary all over the place, but National Review primarily. I also think, more than anything else, I'm going to be watching for the views of people that I call the old school left. And by this, I mean people. I mean, it's so hard to remember that back in the Clinton administration, as recently as the Clinton White House, a strong defense of religious liberty and of religious minority rights was a primary characteristic of liberalism. And so I've been disappointed just from a brief scanning of the transcript and doing some searches of the whole transcript of the orals for looking for some certain key terms, that the justices were extremely interested in trying to set limits on religious liberty. Where are the limits here? So the liberals came at you with limitations on one side, and then the conservatives came back with limitations on the other. We saw all kinds of fascinating images. One of them, you know, must a gay opera singer consent to perform for the Westboro Baptist Church just because the same opera singer would be willing to perform at the Liberal National Cathedral? Or another one, does an African-American sculptor have to accept a commission to do a cross for a Ku Klux Klan rally? That's a fairly radical image. It's interesting to me that some of the mainstream coverage mentioned, and others didn't mention it at all, the fact that the Colorado civil rights people, the main folks that were on the stand defending their decisions to punish Masterpiece Cake Shop, very few people in the press, in the mainstream coverage as opposed to the commentary, very few people have mentioned that they, on three different occasions, have said that pro-gay rights people don't have to create cakes or artistic expressions for conservatives who have viewpoints that offend them. I'm also noting that very few mainstream stories mentioned that Jack Phillips, the baker in this case, has been extremely consistent in his refusal of cake commissions that he believes violates his conscience, whether that's Halloween, whether that's cakes created for parties to celebrate a divorce. I didn't know people celebrated divorces, but apparently some people might. I read one reference, intriguingly, that he refused a commission to create a cake attacking gay rights or something that could be interpreted in that fashion. So we have all kinds of people trying to find limits, yet I can't find any references anywhere that there was a discussion of the limits on religious freedom and religious liberty in the actual Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA, a piece of legislation approved with only, what was it, three dissenting voices in the U.S. Senate back in the Clinton years. And RFRA has very specific guidelines for what must be present for someone to make a legal request for exemption from existing law. I guess the easiest one to describe would be that you just can't make up a religion all of a sudden. You can't, you know, like say, I'm of the religion of opium and the government has to provide me opium, you know, or something. It has to be an ongoing existing religious tradition, and RFRA, under RFRA, you're supposed to argue that you're dealing with activity that is directly related to an expression of your faith, and if at all possible, an actual ritual of your faith. I think that one of the most famous cases here, I can't remember if you and I have discussed it, was the famous case involving Native Americans and the ritual liturgical use of peyote. And it's very important that, and this is going to come up indirectly before the court this time, the court made it clear that they had a right to use this hallucinogen in rituals that their people have used this drug in a particular liturgical rite, a ritual that's existed for centuries, that they had a narrow exemption to use peyote in that rite. They don't have the right to violate the state or national drug laws and use peyote all the time, just whenever they, what the heck, feel like it. Now, the corresponding arguments in this case before the court, and you saw this repeatedly, Justice Ginsburg asked her, for example, what if it's an item off the shelf? That is, they don't commission a cake just for them, but they walk into the shop, they see a lovely cake, and they say they'd like to purchase it for the celebration of our marriage tonight. Wagoner stressed one of the key findings of this whole case, which is absolutely not. Phillips offered to sell them anything in the store that was already made. He declined to create a cake specifically, a custom artistic created work for their wedding. So here we have a man who's not discriminating against gays and lesbians across the board. He's not asking for a complete, total exemption. My faith tells me I can't sell anything to gays and lesbians. By the way, I'm not aware of any major religion that would try to argue that. I don't even think extreme forms of Islam would try to make a case like that. What he said was, I'm glad to sell you anything that's in my store. I'm willing to deal with you in any possible way, except I don't want to make one of my own personal, unique, individual wedding cakes specifically for your wedding. It's very interesting to realize that the conflict when the two men walked in was so brief that they didn't get into a discussion of what they wanted on the cake. That's a point I made in my piece at Get Religion that came out the morning of the testimony, kind of giving readers a preview of what to look for. And apparently the court has just completely assumed that they wanted a same-sex wedding topper and that they wanted both of their names on the cake, or they wanted something that made it clear that this was a same-sex marriage so that there would be artistic content related to the religious ritual itself in the cake. Apparently, the court just accepted that wholeheartedly, even though some of the coverage beforehand, National Public Radio, for example, said that that was kind of a dissenting point, that they claimed that Phillips couldn't be protesting that they wanted him to do specific content since they didn't even discuss specific content. Phillips made it clear that when one of the men's mothers called back, they got into a lot of details, and he explained why his faith wouldn't allow him to do it.
So that's one of the questions you think we ought to be looking for, which is a question simply posed to the plaintiffs in this case. What did you want him to make for you?
What did you want him to make? And I'm looking for an answer to that. And so far, I can't find any specific information about that. Now, it may be in the transcript, and I just haven't got to it yet. But in the coverage that I've been reading, I haven't seen anything address that at all. But I've also haven't seen anything that said that they argued that they didn't want a specifically same-sex marriage cake. That apparently, yes, they were coming in. They wanted to purchase one of his unique creations for their event because they got mad and left when he said, I'll sell you anything else, but I won't create a specific cake.
I want to ask you about a term that I've seen used on both sides of the reporting. That is the reporting that seems favorable to Phillips and the reporting that seems favorable to the plaintiffs here. And the term is landmark. Does a journalist have a responsibility to do two things if they throw that term out? Unless they're quoting someone else, of course. Explain what a landmark case is and why this one is one. I haven't seen any explanation of either. I've just seen a landmark case.
I think anytime you're dealing with a limitation on the First Amendment or a redefinition of decades of First Amendment law, you have to call that a landmark case. Now, of course, we don't know whether the court will attempt to find some way to split the hair and make this some sort of very narrow ruling that doesn't set a strong precedent. We don't know that. So a large part of a landmark ruling is that it claims that it is a precedent. This is a precedent that affects our entire understanding of the First Amendment, as opposed to a very narrow ruling that says, we think the Colorado Civil Rights Commission screwed up on the following 2 points, and this only applies to that one law in this one state, and they shouldn't have done that. Do you get the distinction?
Mm-hmm.
To me, the big word in all of this that I found fascinating was an actual exchange, once again, with Justice Kennedy, and that was the whole idea when he raised the issue of tolerance. And several of the judges seemed to be searching for some sort of middle ground. In other words, what can we do to try to grant gay and lesbian couples as much freedom as possible without forcing coerced speech on the part of religious believers who are following centuries of doctrine opposing this. And that's why I'm so frustrated that there wasn't a discussion, as far as I know, of RFRA and of the limitations, because we've been down this road before. The problem at this stage is that the modern left, the progressive wing, the sexual liberty school of thinking on these issues, has already rejected RFRA. And RFRA was the compromise. RFRA was the thing that said there is no right to broad discrimination. There is only a right that can be argued, not always granted, but argued for very narrow exemptions, specifically linked to centuries of doctrine, and it has to be linked to an actual act of expression of content of your faith. So if we're seeking compromise, I thought we already had it, but the reason that this is before the court in the first place is that that compromise has been rejected. But you have this very strong quote from Kennedy, where talking when he was grilling, and I think that's an accurate term in this point, he was grilling the Colorado attorney and finally just ended up saying, tolerance is meaningful in society. We must have a society with tolerance. And he said, would you consider that Colorado was making any attempt to show tolerance for the religious beliefs of this man? And he also really worked him over on some statements where people in Colorado referred to his beliefs. I believe the actual quote was that his religious beliefs were found to be despicable, I think was the quote. And Kennedy at that point says, what we're dealing with that is an actual hostility to religion. I think if I can search around here a little bit, I can find the exact term, a despicable piece of rhetoric. And Kennedy says to the poor attorney from Colorado, he says, would you have advised your candidate to use that language? And the guy goes, well, you know, we didn't talk about that. No, I don't think I would have advised. And then Kennedy says to the attorney from Colorado, well, will you reject that language? I mean, you're having a tough moment with a justice when he's asking you as an attorney to personally reject the language used by the people you're defending.
Terry, a real quick question for you here with 30 okay. seconds. Justice Kennedy retires. He was key in Obergefell. Let's just stay on the gay marriage issue.
Right.
And he will be key in this one. You get a chance to interview him, and he says, I'll give you 5 minutes, Terry. What's the question you want him to answer?
First of all, I would ask him what he thought of the limitations in RFRA and whether he thought they could be affirmed in the majority decision, because we've already been through this. Second, it's all going to be about where you draw the line on when discrimination is possible and when not. But I would go right back to him and say, how do you think the state could show tolerance to conscientious objectors in this law? I would ask him if he thought conscientious objector laws and language would apply in this case as well as they have in so many others.
Terry Mattingly is senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thanks for being our guest.
Glad to be here again.
In Hour 2 of Issues, Etc., Aaron Wolf will join us, managing editor of Chronicles, a magazine of American culture. He's authored a recent column there titled Hollywood and Bethlehem. We're going to talk about how Hollywood both celebrates Christmas and makes its money at Christmas. And then our series Christ in the Old Testament continues. We'll be in Psalm 80 with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
Do you have a hard time finding Christian greeting cards and gifts that aren't either sappy or theologically suspect? Ad Crucem offers the perfect combination of art and the truth of the Scriptures with beautiful and reverent greeting cards and gifts. Deliver the true comfort of the gospel, Christ crucified for sinners, to family and friends with Ad Crucem. ADCRUCEM.com. Confessing the faith through art and word. AdCrucem.com.